to get started. So let's first of all go back to this calculation a little bit. This one I think was interesting. Remember, we calculated that the eigenvector corresponding here was uniquely determined. It was the reproducing kernel, K lambda, and the other elements in the kernel were polynomials times that. And the interesting thing about this calculation is that showed that when you restricted S star to the finite dimensional invariant subspace, of course, then you get matrix representation. You can always put it in Jordan canonical form. And this result says that you can't have more than one Jordan block. So this already tells you that the restrictions of S star to finite dimensional subspaces, invariant subspaces, are going to be very special. Right? The reason you can't have more than these, because remember, there's one eigenvector in every Jordan block. But there's only one eigenvector here at all. It's the reproducing kernel. It's the only one. And of course, it must then be in this space. So that's kind of interesting. That says that the Jordan block decomposition of these restrictions are very special. I mean, the different blocks have different lambdas. And therefore, you get that the dimension of the whole space is the sum of the MNs, which is consistent with that formula that we showed at the end, or that I claimed at the end without proof. But in fact, the proof is very simple. You just go through the details and you get the proof right away. That the dimension of the range of the Hankel operator actually coincides with the number of zeros of the Blaschke product here, which coincides with the number of poles of the rational function you get when you take P minus of C. So it's all this, it's quite easy. Anyway, so let's go back to where we were at this point. We're looking at compact, or about to look at compact Hankel operators. Once we know that H infinity plus C is a closed subalgebra, we can actually compute the essential norm of a Hankel operator. I'll remind you, the definition is it's the infimum of operator norms, where K maps, in this case, H2 to H2 minus is compact. Right, so the essential norm of an operator, in our case, from one Hilbert space to another, you just look at the compact operators and you just mod them out. This is essentially what you're doing, you're modding them out. And the theorem is, well, that's the definition. The theorem is that this is equal to the distance in L infinity from the function phi to, well, we don't stop here. This, of course, goes on the circle. If I stop here, this, of course, is Nahari's theorem. This gives you the norm of the Hankel operator, H phi, right? The norm, Hankel operator, H phi. Intuitively, we kind of think that the compact operators are sort of those for which the symbol extends to be continuous on the boundary, maybe with a little extra. So we make it smaller by making the space bigger, and it's that distance. That's our claim. I mean, it seems reasonable to make that claim. And the proof, well, we just go each direction separately, and of course I'm going to have to take my notes along or I'll get it messed up. Oh yeah, so the first one, we just use trigonometric polynomials. So if P EI theta is a trigonometric polynomial, trigonometric polynomial just means a polynomial in Z and Z bar, like I've written here. If P is a trigonometric polynomial, then what do we get? HP is finite dimensional. By Kronecker's theorem. Remember, Kronecker's theorem was much harder than I had anticipated it would be. It was all that matrix stuff. And somehow, this was essentially the main event in the theorem. The fact that when you restricted S star to an invariant finite dimensional subspace, it has a Jordan canonical form, and it has a very specific form, et cetera, et cetera. Otherwise, it seems to me that was the main event in this theorem. Okay, so if P is a trigonometric polynomial, then this is Kronecker's theorem. Well, why is that? That's because P minus of a polynomial is just the P minus of a polynomial EI theta is just the sum of the ans over z to the n, n equals minus n to minus 1. But you just look at the negative Fourier coefficients, and of course, e to the minus I theta can be on the circle written as that. So it's just that rational function. Notice all the poles are at the origin, in fact. So it's by Kronecker's theorem, you get that's HP is finite dimensional. And hence compact. Right. Operators. Yeah, over z to the n, yeah. Yeah, that's just, yeah, you have to get used to this. We use this all the time. We use the fact that it's, rational. Is a polynomial divided by a polynomial and then linear sum? I just flip them around. I mean, you get e to the minus I theta by taking n negative here, and then I wrote n positive here. I just got mixed up. Yes, you're right. It was a mind typo. Okay, so these are HP is then compact, and so we get a one direction of our inequality. Thus, if F is continuous on T and PNs converge to F uniformly on T, that's because trigonometric polynomials are dense in C of T. We get that HF is compact. For F and C of T, by Nahari's theorem, since what is the norm of H of F minus PN, and that's equal to F minus PN L infinity, and that goes to zero. Right, the Hankel operator is always, its norm is equal to or less than the L infinity norm of the symbol, always. And here it goes to zero. So that shows that that HF is a norm limit. Yeah, this is in the norm Oh, because this is HF minus HPN, right? HF minus HPN. It's a norm limit of compact operators. Okay, so for continuous functions on the circle, the Hankel operators are compact, using Kronecker's theorem and the standard stuff in functional analysis. And now we can get the first inequality in our theorem. Thus what? So we look at the distance in L infinity from phi to H infinity plus C. Well, the first thing we want to do is eliminate the C, which we can because F continuous. So this is the infimum over F and C of T of the distance between phi and phi minus F to H infinity. Right? This is just taking out the infimum over the F and C part, subtracting it from here. The same as that distance. And this, by Nahari's theorem, is the infimum over F in C of T of H of phi minus F. But H of phi minus F is, of course, just H of phi minus H of F. Right? This is Nahari's theorem. And since these H of Fs are compact, this is just part of the infimum we have to take in order to get the essential norm of H phi. Right, the essential norm of H phi is where you subtract all compact operators and try to minimize the norm. Here we're subtracting certain compact operators. Well, that gives us one of the inequalities in this equality. And then for the other direction, it's a little bit longer. So conversely, let S be the shift on H2, or multiplication by Z. If so, if K is compact, mapping H2 to H2 minus, if it's compact, like it is in the where we're taking the infimum up there, then we have the following easily established property. We have to prove it, of course. Then K, Sn, in norm, goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. So this is the norm of the operator, K times the shift to the nth power. The norm of that actually goes to 0. So it's a fairly strong statement. And the proof is you build up compact operator from finite dimensional range operators. So the first thing you do is we're going to prove this if K is a one-dimensional operator. In other words, its rank is 1. Well, that's what we're going to use in the proof. We're going to use that fact, but it's not enough to show that the norm goes if you just show it goes on every vector. We're going to show that and then work our way up using the fact that compact operators are norm limits of finite dimensional operators. And we'll get the finite dimensional one from the one dimensional one. So let's just write it as follows. If K is one dimensional, say, so what does K of X look like? it's going to be just an inner product times a fixed vector. So that's going to be x. F times G for some fixed F in H2, G in H2 minus, right? So a one-dimensional operator, of course, is a multiple of a fixed element of the range. And what element? Well, it has to be linear. So linear functionals are given by dot products with elements of the space. In this case, we now see that KSN in norm is equal to what? Well, if you applied the SN in here, what would you get? You'd get that, but then you would put the SN over here as S star to the N. So for fixed N, the norm of this operator is, of course, just the norm of this as a linear functional times the norm of that vector in H2 minus. So this is exactly equal to S star N F, that's in H2, of course, times G in H2 minus. Very simple operator. But now we're okay because this guy in norm goes to zero as N goes to infinity. Just look at the Fourier coefficients of F. Right? I mean, I'll just draw the picture. You'll see it. 0, 1, 2, 3. So here's the coefficients, f hat 2, f hat 3. And, of course, they're all 0 out here. If you apply the backward shift to f, you simply move the coefficients back. So the H2 norm of that is the sum of the squares of the coefficients beyond n, or equal to or greater than n, right? So if you shifted this back, k times, remember the shift operator, it's not isometric, right? It drops off the coefficients. So if you shifted it n times, the one at 0 would be f hat n. Then you'd have f hat n plus 1. And of course, the H2 norm of that function is the sum of the squares of f hat, but from n on. And obviously, if n goes to infinity, that goes to 0. It's a convergent series. Okay, so that's the one-dimensional operator. Just the fact that the shift drops the coefficients off one by one and leaves you with nothing in the limit. Well, the same thing is then true for a finite-dimensional operator, because a finite-dimensional operator can be represented as a sum of things like this, where you have fk and gk, summing k from 1 to n. And you just notice that each one of these that happens, and so therefore, you're done. So now we know it for finite rank operators. So if I give this thing a name, call it maybe star. So by linearity, star holds for k finite rank. And I'll write this out, but then taking limits, we get star for compact operators, or for compact K. And here's the proof. Given epsilon positive, choose L finite rank with k minus l less than epsilon. So you remember that for a compact operator mapping a Banach space into a Hilbert space, it's actually true that you can approximate it by finite rank operators. That's not true for Banach spaces. That was, as Nir asked this question the other day, Rudin points out in his book that was a long-standing open problem. But we're in the Hilbert space. H2 goes to H2 minus. So we can do this for the epsilon. And then of course, it's trivial. I mean, you just write KSN is equal to or less than K minus LSN plus LSN. And that's equal to or less than epsilon plus little O of N. This is that's one, because the shift operator obviously is of norm 1. Or less, and or actually of norm 1 exactly, it's an isometry, and KL, so it has norm less than epsilon. And this goes to 0. So that means that for an arbitrary K, as N goes to 0, you can get it underneath epsilon. Well, epsilon was arbitrary, so that's that. Okay, from this, we can now obtain the opposite inequality in this theorem right here. So we can show that the essential supremum is equal to or less than the distance. And that is done by directly. So thus, H of C minus K, here our K is compact. That norm, well, it's equal to or greater than what? You can put an S to the N in there for free. Simply because this guy is norm 1. Right? So you just, that is equal to or less than the norm of that times the nth power of the norm of S. So you get that. Having put that in, you now use the reverse triangle inequality. This is equal to or less than, or sorry, equal to or greater than HB minus, HVSN minus KSN. So notice now we can see the reason for the previous calculation. In the limit, this is not going to play any role. We just have to verify what this does. And as we'll see in a moment, the norm of HV S to the N is going to be controlled by the fact that we know H infinity plus C is an algebra. Closed algebra, that's the key. So anyways, what happens next? This is equal to the distance in L infinity from, well, what, I mean, I could, what is this HV S N? It's, of course, P minus of Z to the N phi. Right, you just it's the same as shifting phi up. And by Nahari's theorem, this distance of this function, z to the n phi, is the distance of that function to h infinity. So I could write it as z to the n phi to h infinity. That's Nahari's theorem. That's equals. This is equal to that by Nahari. However, because Z is unimodular on the circle, I could just write, because you're taking the distance in L infinity, could just do that. Z bar N. I mean, the Z moves over. This is L infinity norm. And whether you have Z or, you know, put it on the other side doesn't make any difference. The norms are, it's an isometry. So it's the L infinity distance of this, I guess the same thing. And this is equal to or greater than the distance in L infinity from phi. And now we use the fact that z bar n times h infinity is this thing. Right? The z bar to the n is a continuous function. So it's in h infinity plus c. H infinity is in there. The product is in there. And it's closed, and you get the equal to or greater than. And then this guy still stays there. So now what you do, this is now fixed. You now let n go to infinity. That goes to 0, and then you take the infimum over k. So let n go to infinity, and then take inf over k compact. You get the opposite inequality. That's HV star, sorry, essential, HV essential, that's the essential norm, that's the infimum, over K, HV minus K, equal to or greater than this distance. So, as you can see, we've entered a different world. On T. It's continuous on T. Yeah, you have to keep... This is a very tricky business. This is why they go... All these norms are on T. Yet some of the conditions are expressed in terms of saying P minus of something is a rational function. Then you have to interpret it. They go back and forth from the disk to the complement of the disk and to the circle. It's always very tricky. That's what I meant by we've entered a different world. This is more algebra. Okay, it's got a lot bigger component of algebra in it than some of the things we were doing before. Even the interpolation and Corona theorem didn't have this much algebra in them. So all the tricks here are algebraic. They're very tricky stuff. And as a result, I don't have a really good intuitive feeling for why they work. I don't know how they invent these proofs. I just repeat them for you right now. I'm trying to understand them better. But it appears to me still kind of mysterious. Saracen had a lot to do with it. Saracen proved that H infinity plus C was a closed subalgebra. And since that's the main event in the proof of this, I don't know who did H infinity. I don't know who computed the essential norm. It could have been Saracen, likely. He did a lot of this stuff. He was very big on this stuff. Oh, incidentally, I want to... Well, this comes up in the next theorem. This is why I remembered it. But I've reversed myself now. I've gone back to the supposition that in order to get the solution to our Corona problem that motivated tuplets and Hankel, all the stuff in L2 in the Hilbert space, we don't ever need Fefferman's theorem that the dual of H1 is this bounded mean oscillation thing, nor do we need Saracen's theorem that the vanishing mean oscillation subspace is the set continuous plus conjugative continuous. We've proven Fefferman's duality. We will prove Saracen's theorem too, but I want to emphasize that we haven't actually used those theorems, you know, for anything else yet, and we won't. So I'll try to do it up until we run out of time, and then I'll have to wave my hands, because you have to be, it's more algebraic, always using the L infinity plus L infinity tilde norm rather than the BMO norm. But in the next theorem is I think the main one, where everybody states it in terms of Saracen's characterization of VMO, but in fact you don't need it, and we won't use it either. So here's our corollary. This is Hartmann's theorem, and it's sometimes also called the Hartmann-Saracen theorem because of the VMO connection. But I'll put that in the remark. So Hartmann's theorem is the following: let C be an L infinity. So it's a symbol for a tuplets or Hankel operator, then the following are equivalent. One, HV is compact. Two, C is in H infinity plus C. Oh, I could have read that off from the previous result. That's kind of obvious. Phi is in H infinity plus C. We can actually see that right away without even mentioning it in the proof. The main part of the proof is showing the connection with part three, which is P minus of phi is in continuous plus conjugate of continuous. Why is the equivalence of the first two obvious from the previous theorem that said that these things were equal? Well, first of all, if the symbol is an H infinity plus C, this distance is zero. So by the equality, the essential norm of H phi is zero, which means that the infimum of these things is zero. But that means that H phi is a norm limit of compact operators, therefore it itself is compact. Conversely, if H phi is compact, then of course you just take, you get zero here, and the distance is zero. And because H infinity plus C is closed, C must be in it. Maybe I should write that out. Because it does use the previous theorem plus the fact that H infinity plus C is a closed set. So let's quickly prove this. It's not hard. But we'll be careful to note that we can go from 3 back to 1 without using anybody's fancy characterization of that set. Okay, proof. If 1 holds, then of course the essential 0 is the essential norm, which is the distance in L infinity from phi to that implies that phi is actually in it, since this thing is closed. That's property 2. Conversely, actually, we're going to show that 2 implies 3 and 3 implies 1, but let's just show that 2 implies 1 is equally easily, or equally easy. Conversely, if 2 holds, then you know that the essential norm is 0. So then 0 equals the distance from C to H infinity plus C, which is then the essential norm of that. Which is the inf over k of hv minus k. So since that's zero, that implies hv is a norm limit of compact operators. And it's compact. And that's true even in the context of Banach spaces. Always norm limits of compact operators are compact, but you need the range to be a Hilbert space if you want to go the other way. Or at least there's counterexamples to the general statement. So let's now show 2 implies 3 implies 1. And then we'll take a break. 2 implies 3. Oh, no, we started at 9:30. I'm confused, right? We started at... Yeah, we'll take a break in about 10 minutes. That must be wrong. I don't feel like we've been here very long. Okay, so maybe we'll go a little further. Seems too early to take a break, but you know, that's bad. Roughly, okay. So just after 11:30 on that thing, whatever that means. Okay. 2 implies 3. If 2 holds, that means that phi is equal to some holomorphic function, which I'm going to call h. H in H infinity, V in continuous, then P minus of phi is of course P minus of H plus V. That's just P minus of V. The H is holomorphic, so of course P minus kills it. And what's P minus? Well, it's a linear combination of identity and conjugate operator, constant. And that thing is obviously in C plus C tilde. Right? I mean, the V minus V naught is continuous, and the V tilde is in C tilde. V is continuous. So it's just trivial. And now 3 implies 1 is easy. Not trivial, but easy. So here's the part where in my notes I wrote by the boundedness of the conjugate function on BMO, but we don't, and I was thinking of the bounded BMO, we don't need that. So we'll just argue directly, so I'm going to change the argument here a little bit. So three holds. What does three say? So if P minus of phi is U plus V tilde, with both U and V continuous, then with PR, the Poisson kernel, with R, of course, between 0 and 1, we have the following. By Nahari's theorem. You'll notice that Nahari's theorem gets used all the time. And we don't even write it. It's used every argument, every time. So it's really the cornerstone of all of this stuff, is Nahari's theorem. But not the BMO part, just the fact that it's the dual on H1, which can be expressed as L infinity plus conjugate L infinity. Incidentally, that, of course, is the reason why the first step in function theory on the Pauli disk was to establish Nahari's theorem. That's the thing that Lacy did with Terwilliger, at first with Ferguson, then Terwilliger. So it's the key to everything, at least on the disk. Okay, continuing on, where do we go? So this is the Poisson kernel. We have that H of phi minus. So what's our strategy going to be? Well, the strategy is going to be fairly simple, and that is that PR phi is clearly a continuous function. Because it's shrinking the function inside. I mean, you take the Poisson kernel, and if you take P minus of that, we'll see is going to be a continuous function. Anyways, let's just look at this. H minus HPR is equal to P minus of phi minus P minus of PR phi in, and what is this by Nahari's theorem? It's the H10 star, the dual norm. And as we pointed out, we can write that as L infinity plus L infinity conjugate. Remember, because we could put here, you could put there BMO, but BMO is also equal to real part H1 star, and that was L infinity plus L infinity tilde, but you don't need to go through that. You can just use the Hahn-Banach theorem to extend the continuous linear functional on H10 to a linear functional on real part of H1 with the same norm. And then you know that we can identify that dual with this space. That was the functional analysis. Hmm? Oh. Thank you. Yeah. It's P minus. PR is the Poisson kernel. So it's convolution with the Poisson kernel on the circle. It's a convolution operator. So it's this norm, and now we just have to keep track, because P minus, and without solving the stuff, let me just say that P minus is in the span of the identity and the conjugate operator, and the constant, subtracting a constant operator. So that's because of the formula I wrote down before about the tilde, right? V tilde was, I don't even remember what it was now, but it's clear that you can solve this for this thing. It's in the span of those things. And also, what is fee? Fee. I wrote fee somewhere. It was, P minus fee is what I wanted, of course. P minus fee is U plus V tilde. So, and P minus phi, which is, how do I do this? So I didn't type this out, of course, so I can't copy it. But P minus is in there. So what I want to do is multiplication by a constant, period. That's the identity map. This is the map. Oh.
The formula that it's in the right above. I mean, you can divide
those. Ah, there it is.
It's a formula.
Yeah. So maybe I should be a little bit more specific. Maybe I should say P minus of phi, because after all, the P minus and the PR commute. So what we can say is that P minus of phi is in the span of phi tilde, and I guess the constant just keeps you in there. Just another multiple of phi. So it's in the span.
No, it's
1. 1. Right. It's in the span of that. And, which of course is the span of. And now you get U plus V tilde. And now what's the tilde of that? That's U tilde plus, and now V is just, well, it's the, you know, the reflection of V. You replace X by minus X. So that's V check. So it's that, and 1, which we can write as the span of. Now there's U, V check, and 1, those of course are all continuous, plus, and over here is the span of U and V tilde. So, in other words, you can use the algebra to write P minus of phi as a continuous function plus the conjugate of some other continuous function. And there's coefficients involved with U's and V's and 1's. V check of X, or of Z, is V of Z bar. In other words, it's the function that sends theta to minus theta on the circle. That, yeah, because when you take two Hilbert transforms, you get that. That's in C plus C tilde. Okay, so what have I... but of course, what I... Right. So if we continue with this thing, this will be equal to identity minus PR times P minus V in L infinity plus L infinity tilde. Okay, and now I know what P minus C is. It's in the span of all this junk. But the I minus PR, because the identity commutes with all of these things, so does the PR. So I can take the I minus PR, I probably should have arranged to do that at the beginning, I minus PR of this thing is P minus of I minus PR of the phi. So this is equal to, I should have written it the other way, I'm just I minus PR of phi, which I can put on even on the U and the V. So it's I minus PR on the U plus I minus PR on the V tilde. Because what I had here was I minus PR times U plus V tilde. But you can put this inside. And now you use, now I should apply this algebra that P minus of this stuff, maybe I shouldn't have written this just yet. So maybe I did this all for nothing, I don't know. But P minus, so this is the new U. Call this U naught, or maybe U sub R. And call this, before the tilde, call it V sub R. So U sub R is U minus PRU. V sub R is V minus PRV. And then, what I could get is that if I went back up to phi and looked at, instead of that, looked at P minus of whatever this is, UR plus VR tilde. In other words, the U and the V, get replaced by tildes everywhere. So you don't change this, this is the span of UR, VR, UR, VR, VR. Right? You just do that calculation again, but with these continuous functions in place of those ones, and you get that thing is in the span, is in this class. But then what's the L infinity plus L infinity tilde norm of that function? Right? What's the L infinity plus L infinity? It's the infimum of the sums of the L infinity norms over all representations of this as this. So it's equal to or less than the L infinity norm of these things with bounded coefficients and those guys with bounded coefficients. And of course, as R goes to 1, those L infinity norms go to 0 because U and V are continuous. So that means this thing equals this L infinity plus L infinity tilde, which is equal to or less than some huge constant times the L infinity norm of UR plus the L infinity norm of VR. Oh, and this 1 just goes away because it's 1 minus the plus on kernel. The 1 has just gone away. It's just those. And that goes to 0 as R goes to 1. Okay, so that takes me back to where I said I was going to be at the beginning. H phi is a norm limit of H PR phi. And now the PR phi is a continuous function. So H of that is compact. So the algebra gets a little messier. I'll write that out. The algebra gets a little messier with not using the VMO norm. I mean, I'll just point out what you would do if we used the BMO norm, what we would do instead. But so finally, the result is thus, or since PR phi, which is equal to PRU plus PRV tilde, which is QRV, this is the conjugate plus on kernel, and of course, on a continuous function, QR is a nice L1 kernel for R less than 1. It's just that its limit is bad. But for any fixed R, I should be careful. Oh no, I don't need to be careful. PR phi is continuous. I don't need norm control. I don't need norm control. I just need to know it's continuous. And QR of V is obviously continuous. QR, you can write the kernel down. It blows up badly as R goes to 1, but for any fixed R less than 1, it's just the kernel. and a convolution kernel, and it takes continuous functions to continuous functions. Okay, and then by the previous, somewhere we proved, I guess here, the equivalence of 1 and 2. We already know that for a continuous function, for a continuous symbol, HV is compact. So we're using the fact that 2 implies 1. I thought we proved it earlier, but maybe we didn't. 2 implies 1, which we already showed, shows that H of PRV is compact. And now what we have shown here is that HV is a norm limit of compact operators, because that norm goes to 0. It's compact, so HV is compact. Okay. Suppose, instead of being stubborn and not using Fefferman's theorem, suppose we just write BMO here. We've already established that the projection operator P minus is bounded on BMO because it's a linear combination of identity and conjugate. And therefore, the BMO norm of this is equal to or less than the BMO norm of, you can take the P minus away. You can also replace the phi by U plus V tilde, and you can take the tilde away from B, because the BMO norm of V tilde is equal to the rest of the B. So you end up getting the BMO norm of, down here, you get the BMO norm of UR, which is, remember, U minus PRU, and the BMO norm of V minus. However, the BMO norm is equal to or less than the L infinity norm. So you get this anyways. Yeah, BMO is a bigger space. Bigger space, smaller norm. So, I mean, it looks much cleaner if you just use the BMO norm, because you don't have to... See, this norm is only difficult because you have to make sure you arrange everything to look like that, so you can take the infimum over representations. Anyways, I think it's kind of interesting to note that we don't need Fefferman's duality theorem yet, and I don't think we will use it. Okay, so that's... That's Hartmann's theorem. Oh, and now I said I would prove Saracen's theorem anyways. Even though I don't think we'll ever use it, it's an important theorem. Okay, Saracen has many theorems. So this is going to be in the form of a remark. Why? Because I'm just going to sketch the proof. It's not going to be as detailed as everything else. So remark, Saracen has shown that C plus C tilde equals VMO, where what's VMO? VMO of T is the closed subspace of BMO that's the bounded mean squared oscillation being finite space of Fefferman's is the closed subspace of VMO that consists of those F, of course, in BMO, with the following thing. If you look at the what I called the star seminorm, that is the mean square oscillation seminorm, and you let the arc length tend to zero, the oscillation doesn't just remain bounded, it actually tends to zero. So it's vanishing mean oscillation. Meaning that as you go down closer and closer scales, the oscillation gets less and less, and is zero in the L2 norm in the limit. So so what would that be? You're going to look at 1 over I, the integral over I said F here, so F minus FI, squared. So that's the thing which is supposed to be bounded over all arcs I. And now we want to take the sup over arcs with length equal to or less than delta. So small arcs, we want that to go to zero. Delta goes to zero. So again, the idea is you just take small arcs, and as the in a uniform way, as the arcs shrink, the oscillation goes to zero. Yeah, by the John Nirenberg theorem. I haven't thought about VMO. Continuous are in, that's what the main event. That's probably it. Oh, L infinity is not in it. Yeah. So anything with, I'm just taking an ordinary bump function that jumps with a discontinuity. Yeah. In the BMO norm, yeah, it's the closure, yeah. Continuous, it's just continuous, yeah. Not C0. That function. So, for example, if you take small arcs here, the average is that, and the mean square average is like 1. It doesn't go to 0. Okay, and how do we prove Saracen's theorem?
Which continuous function, which function in VMO is not continuous, for example?
Log. In VMO? Yeah, the log function. there are, by looking at a conformal mapping, you can come up with a continuous, a holomorphic function, a Riemann mapping, whose real part is continuous, but whose conjugate part is not continuous. I can't remember the example right now, but it's in Garnett's book. I could look it up for next time. But you can come up with one for, C tilde will be in there. I mean, we're going to prove that. But C and C tilde are both in there, but C tilde is not bounded. C tilde is not continuous. C tilde is not continuous. All I can tell you right now is that if you look at the Riemann map to say a strip, an infinite strip, obviously the real part is an L infinity function. The imaginary part, the conjugate function, is not L infinity. That's the easy example. Nobody forgets that one, including me. There's another example where you can map the unit disk into something else. And I don't remember what it is. The real, some sort of thing with a kink somewhere. The real part is clearly continuous, but the imaginary part has a discontinuity. So I'll bring that next time, but this is in Garnett's book. The example of the function that works. I just don't remember what it is. This is the only one you can remember because you don't have to remember anything. But yes, okay. I mean, PR and QR are both continuous functions. If we think hard enough, we can come up with an example on our own. Okay, so how does he prove this? So first of all, extend our holomorphic equivalent. You'll recognize it. To the following. So this to arbitrary B's in L2. With now we define BW to be the Poisson extension. Because B is not holomorphic anymore, it's L2, not H2. So if it's just L2, we can still define it inside by taking the Poisson extension. And then it turns out that you get that this B star functional, the soup of the things, is essentially the soup of these guys, B of EIT, Poisson kernel of B, and W, and then PWT. FDT. Remember, we did this for holomorphic functions, B and H2 before. And the idea, I mean, I didn't prove it. I said it followed from standard estimates on the Poisson kernel. You could read the details in Garnett's book. But the intuition is pretty clear, because for a given W, suppose you associate the arc IW, the Poisson kernel, PWT, is something which is looks like 1 over IW there and falls off fairly rapidly. Right? So this height here is 1 over IW. Right, that's what the Poisson kernel looks like. It looks like 1 over IW times the characteristic function of IW plus then a geometric sum of stuff further away that you can bound by the same chunk. But this turns out to be the main term. And if you look at this, what, and of course, what's P of BW? This is essentially, this part is essentially, it can plays the role of an average over IW of IWB. So it plays the role of the average. So this looks an awful lot like the left-hand side. It looks like, and of course, the integral here is essentially just over IW. I said it's basically the characteristic function of IW. The rest of it can be ignored. So intuitively, you think of this as just the integral of over IW of what? B minus its average squared times 1 over the measure of IW. It's exactly the mean square oscillation. I mean, that's what it looks like. And you can actually show two-sided estimates. It's equal to or less than that soup, and conversely, this soup is equal to or less than this one. So, yeah, we already stated this without proof. Yeah, well, H2 is L2 functions that are holo- with negative Fourier coefficients vanished. Now we're just letting the negative Fourier coefficients be there, too. The Poisson extension is harmonic, yeah. I mean, B and L2 doesn't have any meaning anywhere unless you make it. So we define it to be the Poisson extension inside. Remember, L2 is contained in L1 on the circle, so everything is fine. And so this gives us a nice thing to play the role. If B was holomorphic, this would be B of W, right? The Poisson integral of the holomorphic function is the function. So it reproduces it. But anyway, I didn't prove that before. I'm not going to prove it now, but it does follow from that estimates in that picture I just explained. If you write it all out, it's not hard. So, okay, we have that. It's that extension. And with that extension, we can now do something useful. Oh, there's a moreover. We go one more paragraph. There's a good place to stop. Because that's one thing we need. Here's the other ingredient we need. Moreover, B is in VMO if and only if the analogous thing happens here. This is the other thing we needed. So this is limit. R goes to 1, and now you take the soup of W's, you take the soup of W's from R to 1. So you're taking the soup of W's out here. So the corresponding arcs have length small, 1 minus R. So this is like, anyways, and then you take the soup of those things, integral BEIT, minus the Poisson integral W squared PW TDT. Remember, our definition of vanishing mean oscillation was that in the definition of this soup, as you let the arcs go to zero, the oscillations went to zero. The analogous thing is true with this characterization. What corresponds to letting the arcs go to zero? What corresponds to letting the arcs go to zero is letting the modulus of W go to one, right? So I'm not proving it, but I'm claiming it's the same thing. If you look at the vanishing oscillation there and compare it, you get two-sided estimates. Okay, and with that, we can now carry out a fairly straightforward proof, although there's a little bit of an iteration because I'm taking this out of Garnett's book. One way turns out to be easy. The other way, the in other words, to show that C plus C tilde is in VMO follows immediately from this stuff. The harder part is if you have a vanishing mean oscillation function, how do you represent it as C plus C tilde? Well, Pfefferman has shown that, of course, because it's also L infinity plus L infinity tilde, Pfefferman has shown that you can represent it as a BMO function, and then we just have to... So you can represent it as L infinity plus a conjugate L infinity, and then we have to show by an iteration argument that those L infinity functions can actually be made continuous. That's the hard part. There's an iteration. But it's not that hard. But the reason I'm calling it as a sketch is because I'm probably not going to give all the details. But still, I think you'll believe it. It's a very, very believable result. So, yeah, I guess we'll start up again at 10 to 12, 13 minutes. Let's finish this argument of Saracens. So as I said, from these two facts, we immediately get one containment. C of T is contained in VMO, obviously. And C of T tilde is also by the above. And what? The fact we also had an identity before that for any fixed B, if you integrate over T, D of EIT, if you put tildes on it, minus B of so B tilde EIT squared P W P W T DT is B EIT minus P B W P W T DT. So you get equality with the tildes and this. And the way we proved that before was you make a change of variable, the automorphism of the disk, to take W to zero. And when W is zero, this is just Poincaré's theorem with the tildes. Oh, this is of course let me put Weigel on it because I'm worried about what happens if the integral of B is not zero. So let's just not even worry about it. But you can by a change of variable take it to W equals zero where you can verify that. And the general change of variable thing, it's just the change of variable in the Jacobians for these things. Work it out. Okay, so we won't do that. But those two things together obviously work, right? Because we now know that VMO is equivalent to this limit being zero. But in this limit, you can also put tildes there. So this limit is zero if and only if the same thing with tildes is zero. So if you know it's zero for the B in continuous, you know it's true for B tilde. Now, conversely, is a little tougher. And here we need yet another characterization of VMO. And I'll state two, even one we don't need, just because they're similar and we should know this, even if we don't know how to prove it. So conversely, we use B is in VMO if and only if, and this is limit as theta goes to zero, this is the one we don't use, B of theta plus T minus B of T in the star norm is zero. So this one says that if you translate a B, so you have this B, if you translate it a little bit, so there's the B of theta plus, then in the star norm it's continuous. Translation is continuous in the star norm. And if and only if that, also, if and only if, take the limit in the other, well, the R variable. R goes to 1 of B minus PR convolved with B in the star norm. Okay, so this one is related to that one. And that is you have your function B And now if you convolve with BR, you're simply taking a weighted sum of translates, right? That's what convolution is. You take weighted sum of translates, so you're going to get PR with V. Okay, so both of these are alternate characterizations about continuity of translation in star and, of course, continuity of convolution with Poisson integral in star. Both reasonable. You'd be really surprised if they weren't true. But anyway, we're not going to prove them. Yes, yes, yes. That was Chervon's comment. Yes. Yes, from here. These are continuous functions. And in the star norm, B is the limit of its Poisson integrals. Always, for every B in VMO. Okay, now, if B is in VMO, then, in particular, B is in BMO, and now we're going to use Pfefferman's, not Pfefferman's, it's said to be Pfefferman. Incidentally, we could have, no, I guess not. At this point, I guess we're stuck with the mean oscillation thing. So if we use Pfefferman's norm, it says it's the same as the continuous linear functional in H1, which by functional analysis is the same as L infinity plus L tilde. So this is B is equal to some constant plus U1 plus U2 tilde, where alpha is constant, just a constant number, and U1 and U2, UJ, are in L infinity. What we want, of course, is to show that they're continuous. I mean, we would like to have such a representation where U1 and U2 are continuous, right? That's the conclusion we're looking for, because we want to show that VMO now is contained in C plus C tilde. Well, this shows it's contained in L infinity plus L infinity tilde, which really doesn't say much. But, so here's the trick that you get out of Garnett's book. I don't know if this is Saracen's original proof or not. Saracen sometimes tends to give his proofs in very abstract form. And then sometimes Garnett comes along and gives them in more elementary form. So I don't know if this is his original proof or not. Okay, so the idea, of course, is to take Poisson integrals, because Poisson integrals will make U1 and U2 continuous. And we just have to show that they're close in the BMO norm. So we can choose Poisson integrals of U1 and U2, for which PR convolved would be as close in the star norm. And then we can, you know, write B is equal to, well, you take those particular continuous ones, then you still have an error term. But the error term has small star norm. So you repeat and you iterate and you get a summable thing of continuous functions that converge uniformly because the... So that's the idea. It's a fairly simple idea. So you pick one, pick R, less than one, such that B minus PR involved with B is less than a half B star. So the iteration next time will be a quarter, next time will be an eighth. So you first of all pick an R such that this happens. Let VJ upper 1, this is for our first approximation, of T be equal to PR convolved UJ T, and this of course for J is 1 and 2. So you just take the Poisson kernel of U1, the Poisson kernel of U2, and I'm going to call them, this is for this fixed R, I'm going to call them V1 first approximation, V2 first approximation. So the upper subscript indicates the number, the approximation number, how we're labeling them. Okay, so what do we get out of this? VJ1, of course, is continuous, and we get the following estimate on its L infinity norm equal to or less than a constant
B star. Hmm? Not so far. Maybe it's supposed to be zero, the integral. I don't know. Okay, so this statement, where does this come from? As I say, I left out a lot of details. It seemed obvious at the time I wrote it. So that's the Poisson integral of uj. Oh, that, yes. Well, because the Poisson integral of uj in L infinity norm is equal to or less than uj in L infinity norm. And that is equal to or less than a constant times the star norm of B if B has mean zero. Because the decomposition here, the decomposition into BMO has UJ L infinity equal to or less than B BMO. But the, I mean, that's the definition of, that's his decomposition. You can do it with norm control. That's Stefferman's theorem. You can do it with norm control. And of course, the BMO norm is the star norm if the integral of B over T is zero. Otherwise, the BMO norm is alpha plus. I mean, it's the integral. Yeah. That's the normal. Yeah, in other words, that's the reason for the constant. This constant is the average of U1, because U tilde already has mean zero by definition. So this is the average of U1. And the reason we separated it out is because to make a norm for BMO, right, the star norm kills constant. So to make a norm for it, you have to add this back in. And I claim that what Fefferman's theorem says is that the L infinity norms of the U1 and U2 are not dominated by the alpha, they're dominated by the rest of it, the star part. That's what Fefferman's theorem says. I mean, obviously the alpha should play no role, and it doesn't, in terms of the L infinity norms of these guys. So from that, we then get this. So yes, you are right. I forgot to put in that the integral of B is zero, because I want the BMO norm to be equal to the star norm. Otherwise, that alpha could, well, it would just play havoc. I guess you could carry it along as a fixed constant, and it would get decreased by a half every step. Probably would work. I don't know. Then the remainder R1, which is equal to what? B minus alpha plus the first approximation V1 plus the first approximation for V2. That is B minus PR convolved with B. Right, the alphas cancel. That's just the definition. And so R1 in the star norm is less than a half B star because of this. Okay, so what do we have? I mean, this is obviously now set up for an iteration. So we applied the trick of, first of all, choosing an R so close to 1 that we got the difference of less than half the B star norm, the star of the B. And then you get two things. Then you look at your approximations. The approximations satisfy a uniform bound in terms of the original B star, and this prescribed smaller bound in terms of the error term. So now you repeat this. If we repeat it, we get, of course, repeat it applied to what? Applied to this guy.
This is now the B, the remainder term. Then apply it again. And this time we apply the same thing, and we get a half times a half is a quarter. So you apply same procedure. The only thing that changes, of course, is a different R. Right? You get a different R, obviously, because you want the new R to be such that R1 minus PR of R1 is less than a half of star of R1. I mean, you just replace B everywhere by R1. So apply same procedure with B replaced by R1 to get, and then what do you get? You get V2J is continuous. And it satisfies the estimate L infinity, V2J L infinity equal to or less than, and now it's a constant times the R1 star. But from the previous thing, it's a half B star. And the new R2 which is the obvious remainder is going to be a half of R1 star which is equal to or less than a quarter B star. Okay, so now you can let me cheat because I'm on the blackboard. I'll do it with red chalk. If you apply this n times, you get here 1 over 2 to the n b star, and you get here 1 over 2 to the n plus 1 times a constant. Sorry, constant on this one. On this one, there's no constant. Constant is the same each time. It doesn't iterate. So now you should be able to add them up. And so what do we get? Apparently we get B is equal to alpha plus the sum K equals 1 to infinity, the kth approximation V1, the kth approximation V2, tilde, this is when you take the limit, and this is alpha plus V1 plus V2 tilde, where each of these things, this is the V2, this is the V1, and by the L infinity estimates, and the fact that each of these things is continuous, and their norms are, some of them, the limits are continuous. So you get that V1 and V2 are continuous. Uniformly. Tilde. This guy converges inside the tilde sign. And then the final thing is you have to show that, so what you get is partial sums. You have to show that the limit, the tilde of the limit of the partial sums is the partial, the limit of the partial sums of the tildes. But that, I'll just leave that. Should be standard. Okay, so it depended strongly on this decomposition of Pfefferman. And then you extracted continuous things out of it. Okay. So that's that. Now, we move on to best approximation.
So that's it for compact Hankel operators for a moment. They certainly have not ended, but now we want to take another point of view on them. Best approximation. In the L infinity norm, sometimes by boundary holomorphic functions, sometimes by holomorphic functions with BMO boundary values. It's BMO analytic. So let me just call this section best approximation. Okay. We'll point out not all details. Will be given from here on. However, I think everything still makes good sense with what I will give. First of all, let's recall something. Given an operator T on a Hilbert space to a Hilbert space, the example that we will use in a moment, so just for you to keep in mind, is a Hankel operator composed with projection onto the holomorphic thing, mapping L2 to L2. Okay, remember, our Hankel operators are defined from H2 to H2 minus. Well, you can consider them as operators from L2 to itself by simply looking at it as you first project to L2, multiplied by phi, and project to H2 minus, and you project to H2 plus, H2 first, multiplied H2 minus. If H phi is compact from H2 to H2 minus, then of course this guy is going to be compact from L2 to L2, which is trivial. So that's the model that you should have in mind as we go through the mumbo jumbo over here. So given T mapping H to H, H is a Hilbert space, we define the Hilbert-Schmidt HS norm of T by the following expression. Well, we define the square of the Hilbert-Schmidt norm to be the following sum. N equals 0 to infinity, the norm of TVN in H squared. And I'll write this in a different way, but first of all, this is for any orthonormal basis Vn of H. So you take your L2. So in our case, we're of course going to take for the orthonormal basis Z to the power N, N in Z.
Right? Negative and positive powers of Z form the standard Fourier series orthonormal basis of L2. That's what it'll look like over here. This is then equal to sum n equals 0 to infinity of the inner product TVN, TVN, and this is the inner product of VN, T star TVN. Of course, T star T is a self-adjoint operator. Remember that the T, this one we have in mind, the Hankel operator, these things are not normal operators. They don't commute with their adjoints. You can't apply the standard spectral theorem to them. Like, they're not diagonalizable in any sense. And in fact, a large part of what we would do if we were to continue eventually is to analyze the sort of model spaces. That's the nilpotent parts of these operators. As a substitute for the Jordan canonical form, which, according to Nikolsky, is not all that useful in infinite dimensions. I don't know why he says that. So I don't know why it's so useless in infinite dimensions, but he says that. And so mainly people have turned to this model theory instead, which is studying, well, the sort of thing we've already come up against. H2 minus BH2, right? That's a general description of the S invariant subspaces of H2. last comment about the generality stuff that we won't get to. If you replace holomorphic functions by Hilbert space-valued holomorphic functions, then the Burling theorem and all those invariant subspaces, all that stuff goes through and actually gives you a model for the general bounded operator on a Hilbert space, the important part anyways, analyzed via those things. It's a surprising connection to me anyway, that this abstract operator theory is so connected to holomorphic function theory in the disk, except that the values are Hilbert space values. But that doesn't really matter much. The fact that, you know, your coefficients in your Taylor series expansion live in C, that's the simplest Hilbert space, if they live in another Hilbert space, it doesn't make any difference to all the formulas. And that's sort of an eye-opening observation, that you can actually analyze general operators from that perspective. But let's come back to this one. So we define the Hilbert-Schmidt norm to be this for any orthonormal basis. So the first thing you're going to want to know is, well, it should be independent of the orthonormal basis. And it is. And we can see that by what I just said, that T star T is a self-adjoint operator on L2. Okay, if T is compact, then there's an orthonormal basis of eigenvectors of that self-adjoint compact operator. If T is compact, which of course our Hankel operator will be, provided phi, the symbol, is in VMO. That's by the theorem we just went through. So if T is compact, then T star T is compact self-adjoint. Well, in particular, then it commutes with its adjoint, and because it's self-adjoint, and the eigenvalues are all going to be non-negative, and the spectral theorem applies. And in fact, because it's compact, you get convex self-adjoint. Hence, the spectrum of TT star consists of eigenvalues whose moduli decrease to zero. Well, but in fact, since it's self-adjoint, the non-negative eigenvalues, well, I don't have to say moduli because the way I set it up, they're already negative, already non-negative. So here's the picture for the spectrum of T star T, compact self-adjoint operator. The eigenvalues look like this. There's a lambda naught, lambda 1, it may be equal to lambda 2, lambda 3, and there may only be finitely many if there's just a finite, because the positive ones, turns out the kernels are only finite dimensional, the eigenspaces. Typically, you'll have an infinite number of eigenvalues. 0 is the only possible limit point. So that's the picture. This is all standard functional analysis, which we can't do. It'll have to be compact. And not every compact operator has... Well, you'll see in a minute. Well, let's just do it. You'll see in a second. But let's just compute for a minute. I think I wanted to call these taus. Yes, I did. So can we just make this a tau? So that's the spectrum. Are these non-negative... all these positive taus decreasing to zero. And yes, zero can be an eigenvalue. And for zero an eigenvalue, you can have infinite dimensional kernel, of course. I mean, a rank one operator will have just about everything in the kernel. But the positive eigenvalues have finite dimensional kernels. Okay, so then let Wn be an orthonormal set of corresponding eigenvectors. An orthonormal basis of
corresponding eigenvectors. Okay, so there's a lot of content in there. So these are orthonormal eigenvectors. They span all of your Hilbert space, and they're eigenvectors of those particular guys. Right, so maybe I'll call it J, because I'm going to index with J. And WJ has eigenvalue tau J. Okay, so that's a strong statement, corresponding eigenvector. What's one of the corresponding eigenvectors for C star T, for T star T? Then we get, and now let's compute this, let's continue computing this thing, and we'll see that what we get is always the same number. So now this is the proof that that quantity is independent of the orthonormal basis we choose. Turns out it's going to be the sum of the tau j's. It's just going to be the sum of the eigenvalues of T star T. And of course, that sum, T star T. Yeah, yeah. So for example, as we'll see, that the sum of the tau j's don't have to be finite for a general compact operator. The eigenvalues, they could be 1 over n. But so the idea for Hilbert Schmidt is that the eigenvalues decrease to 0 at a certain rate. Those taus, by the way, turns out that if you look at the spectral decomposition of the compact operator T, those taus are the modulus squared of the eigenvalues here. But we'll get to that in a minute. But first, let's do this calculation. So then we get that this expression we're looking at is this last thing. And now, for Vn, express Vn in the basis Wj. So there's the vector Vn written out in the basis Wj. No. The Vn, no, I'm proving it doesn't depend on the choice. We haven't proven it yet. So the Vn is an arbitrary one. The Wj, however, is a very fixed one. And we're going to show that using the Wj, we can take this expression for any Vn, and we always get the same answer, sum of tau j's, no matter what the Vn's are. Yeah, so we're proving that. And over here, you put this, that's tau I, Wi. And over here, you do the same thing with, you do the same thing inside the T star T, but then, of course, you can move the coefficients outside the T star T. Vn Wj C star T Wj. So you just get that, right? So this sum is initially inside the T star T. I'm assuming T is compact, so you know T star T is bounded. I mean, everything is, you can do this by continuity. Okay, now we use, first of all, the fact that they're eigenvectors. So this expression here is tau j wj. So here you have an inner product of some convergent sums of orthonormal vectors. So the only terms you pick up is when I equals j. Right? I mean, you have to have wi equals wj, or the inner product is zero. If you expand it out as a sum over all i's and j's, only when I equals j you get something, you get 1. Otherwise you get 0. And the convergence implies that all this is legal. So you end up with the sum over j's, 0 to infinity. And then what do you get? You get this. Right. This coefficient came out of a T, the way it is, but then when it passed through the T star,
It's okay, it's everything's scalar.
Now it comes over here and becomes modulus squared. Yeah, I was just getting confused about, so I wanted to write this. That's correct. Because the only time you get anything, the tau j is real, so it stays the same, and this coefficient comes out modulus times that coefficient, because it's an inner product. I was trying to get the bar there, and I forgot that it comes for free. This thing, what's that thing? That is, by Poincaré's theorem, that's the norm squared of Wj. Yes. So let's just do that right away. Let's exchange the order of the summation and put n here and j there. And then what I wrote is true. Right. This is just the sum of the coefficients and the expansion in an orthonormal basis. So finally, as advertised, we do get that this expression over here is always the same thing. It's just the sum of the eigenvalues of t star t, counting multiplicities. So this thing is now well defined. And of course, we're going to apply it to this operator with this basis, because this is the basis on which the Fourier coefficients of phi will show up. And we'll compute it, and we will see that the Hilbert-Schmidt norm of this operator is the remember we had that Besov space b a half 2 on the Schrödinger of the circle? It's exactly that norm squared. That's theorem of Pellerin-Rochberg. I think Peller gets the credit for it, basically. But so let's do that. So the first thing I want to show you is that the Hilbert-Schmidt norm of a Hankel operator h phi is actually equal to this Besov space norm squared of phi. That's the first thing we do. After we've done that, well, actually not quite phi, but p plus of it. Anyway, you'll see. It's a formula. And after we do that, we have to come back to this Hilbert-Schmidt norm again for a moment and characterize these tau j's as being the norm squareds of what are called the singular numbers you associate to t. We'll leave that for a moment. I'm not going to do it. We may not quite get it done today, but in this picture with the eigenvalues, if we were to look at the corresponding picture for the spectrum of t, now, of course, t is just a compact operator. It's not self-adjoint. We don't know anything about its eigenvectors, eigenvalues, except that we know their moduli decrease to zero. And their moduli squared are exactly the taus. But the spectrum of t, the lambda j's, can look like that in complex numbers with limit point zero. If we look at the finite rank operator that you get by taking the biggest n things here and subtracting that off, in other words, you just look at the eigenvectors, you take the dot product on, you know, the projection onto the eigenvectors, and you subtract that off of your operator t, the resulting operator has just those eigenvalues, the remaining ones, and its norm is the sup of the eigenvalues. This is on a Hilbert space for compact operators. So what you get is that by subtracting off these finite rank operators, you can, the norm is just, the norm of subtracting off this, say, four-dimensional operator, you get the norm of that operator is the modulus lambda 4. And in fact, that's the most efficient one to take off, in the sense that the modulus of lambda 4 actually equals the infimum of the operator norms of t minus any four-dimensional rank operator. So suddenly, you now see that there's a connection between this Besov space, which remember comes from the Dirichlet space, the boundary values, and the operator norm of t minus finite rank things. But we know something about finite rank things through Kronecker's theorem. And eventually that ties up together in a very nice theory of approximation. But I'm sort of getting ahead of myself.
let's prove now let's compute that last thing that I set up there. No. For compact operators on a Hilbert space, it's still true. But it's not the spectral theorem proof. I mean, you just have to. Yeah, so you need compact operators on a Hilbert space. So now what? So now let's have a claim. Following theorem. If we look at HV P plus, and we want its norm as an operator from L2 to L2 squared. Oh, incidentally, this is the same as, I already mentioned, it's the same as the operator norm of HV. Okay, that's not the point of the claim, that's just true by mumbo jumbo. This is a projection and a projection. But the claim here, this is the main point of the claim, is that this is equal to P plus of V bar in the space B a half 2 of T that we defined before. So this result is due to Peller, and Rochberg, I think, came up with it independently, but he was a little bit behind, so generally the credit is given to Peller. I'm not sure. It's one of those unclear things. When Peller writes papers, he writes as if he's the only one who ever thought of it. When Rochberg writes papers, he always cites Peller. So I suspect Rochberg came second. But the proofs are completely different. So obviously, they weren't copying each other. They were completely different proofs. Proved the case P between 1 and infinity. You don't see a P here. If I were to put a P in, well, I won't. But it would be the P would be here. BP. And here, instead of the Hilbert-Schmidt norm, would be the forget what you call it, the corresponding LP thing. Instead of taking the L1 sum of the tau j's, you take the power P over 2 instead. Schotten class. The Schotten P class. And of course there it's harder. But for P equals 2, it's really simple. It's just Fourier analysis and this stuff. So let's do that. We get this quite simply. Okay, so we're going to use the orthonormal basis Zn, n in z, of L2t on the operator t equals hv p plus. So then, we get that the Hilbert-Schmidt norm of T, which is, by the way, just the, oh. I wrote the wrong thing here, sorry. This is the Hilbert-Schmidt norm. The Hilbert-Schmidt norm squared, not the operator norm. The Hilbert-Schmidt norm. I mean, obviously the operator norm is equal to is actually the L2 norm of this, right? Because the L2 norm of this is the same as the L2 norm of P minus V, which is the same. Oh, sorry, not L2, BMO norm. That's Nahari's theorem. But if you want the Hilbert-Schmidt norm, you get something other than BMO. You get this space B a half 2. Okay, yeah, so I wrote the wrong thing, sorry. So then we have that the Hilbert-Schmidt norm of T
is equal to, and then we write it out in this form. I better. There's many ways of writing these things, so I better look. So then this is the sum, n equals 0 to infinity, of hv zn with hv zn. And why don't I have to do the negative z's? Because hv lives in h2 minus. There's nothing there. So on that part of the orthonormal basis, there's nothing. It's just 0. So it's just this part of the orthonormal basis. And this is equal to what? So this is the sum n equals 0 to infinity. And then L equals minus infinity to minus 1. This is in L2, of course. But since hv lives in h2 minus, we only have to consider the strictly negative Fourier coefficients of the range. So that's going to be phi hat L minus n squared. Okay, where did this come from? Should be obvious. Oh, right. Because just look at the Fourier series. So what's the Fourier series for h of phi? Let me just draw the picture. That's obvious. So you have phi hat 0, phi hat 1, phi hat 2. And now, for the Hankel operator, you multiply by Zn, which shifts things to the right, and then you project onto the minus. So the HV Z minus has Fourier coefficients phi hat minus n, phi hat 1 minus n, we have 2 minus n, etc. And then when you take the Fourier coefficients, so you take the Fourier coefficients of this. So, oh, sorry. Projected onto the wrong side. Minus 2, phi hat minus 1. Okay, and then, so that's for phi. Then we multiply by Zn. It shifts all the coefficients to the right, n spaces. Then we project, after we've shifted, we project onto here. That's h2 minus. So, what are the coefficients? They will be h hat of, I don't know what they'll be. I can't do this in my head. I just can't. So this one goes, so for example, what sits here? No, phi hat of minus n. Or, I don't know which one of those two, but so if I multiply this by z to the n, this is being multiplied by z to the minus n in the Fourier series. If I multiply by z to the n, this becomes the coefficient at 0. This is why I hate doing this. Because it's a 50-50.
No, but
left shift. No, f is right shift. Multiplication by z to the n is right shift. That's what this is. Multiplication of phi by zn. Right shift. So if I right shift it, then I think that's this one here. And then what's the one previous to that? It's phi hat minus n minus 1.
Yeah, the one before it.
And then phi hat minus n minus 2. So if I chop it off at minus 1, that means I chop it off here. So those are the Fourier coefficients. Now it looks right. So what you do, of course, then you take the Fourier, then you take the L2 norm of that. So you're just taking the sum of the squares of these Fourier coefficients. So you start at phi hat minus n minus 1, and you continue. So it's phi hat of minus n minus 1, and you continue. So that's the correct answer. And then,
and of course, this is what's peculiar, I mean, for me, about this, that all this algebra, the fact that you have to keep in your head correctly which way things go, because you get totally different answers. I mean, the answers don't just look like the reflection of the other answer. They're just completely wrong. And it's just so easy to get it messed up. So that formula is correct. And now, what do we get here? This is going to be, you see, each Fourier coefficient gets summed up several times, roughly L times. So once again, I'm going to copy it, and we can just verify it. So this is equal to the sum, L equals minus infinity to minus 1, of that's how many times the coefficient phi L hat squared gets summed. So for example, suppose L was minus 2. Then it gets summed once when n is 0, or maybe it's flat plus 1. You see, this is where I hate this. What is that equal to? When n equals 0, it's phi hat of minus 1 plus phi hat minus 2 plus. Now, what happens when n is 1? Then it's phi hat minus 2 plus. Yeah, so it's what I said. This gets summed twice. This one's three times. So it's just this formula. And that formula, we already worked this out. This is the sum L equals minus infinity to minus 1 phi hat L z to the L in the Dirichlet space. This is a Dirichlet class function. If I simply put, you see, these L's are negative coefficients, but I'm just putting positive powers on, just because. And L is negative, but L is in there. This function is holomorphic in the Dirichlet space. Compute its norm. No. Just take this function and compute its norm. What do you get? You get that. This is not that function here. So in other words, I've taken the negative Fourier coefficients and I've flipped them around to this side and multiplied them by z to the L.
So to flip, you have to write z to the minus L, no?
Ah, right. You're right. What did I write in here?
Oh.
Ah, I do. I have it wrong. So you're right. It's minus L.
You're right. It has to be flipped.
Very good. It is flipped. Yeah, you see, everybody sees it geometrically, right? You know what it's supposed to be, but the algebra is really tough. And we know what the boundary value is for this. This is equal to p plus c bar
in
the theoretically norm squared, because this function now is this one if you go through it. Because if you take phi bar, the phi bar hat gets barred, and this is barred, and anyway, I'm not going to go through that. That's what it is. And the norm of that in the Dirichlet space is the same as the norm P plus C bar B half 2 squared. Now, I can't remember when we did this B half 2 if we got equality or if it was just approximate equality. It might have been approximate in the sense that, you know, modulus of L was modulus of L plus 1 or something. It might have just been that. And that's all we really care about. So the point is that the Hilbert-Schmidt norm of our operator, that's this guy, turns out to be the B-a-half norm of this. And now once you have the B-a-half norm of that, of course that's the same as P minus of phi in the B-a-half 2. Why? Because this function is the complex conjugate of that function. Remember, you're taking phi bar and projecting to the right. Oh, but that one has the constant term in it, and this one doesn't. Yeah. Well, but no, but we can just say plus phi hat of 0. Because that's the only term missing, is the 0 coefficient. Remember, that's the asymmetry. P plus includes projection onto the constant functions. P minus doesn't include it, so you have to add it back in. Okay, so that's that formula. And now we have to do... Right. So in fact here this shouldn't be, it should be P plus, it should be the projection onto the strictly positive parts. And then you're right. Then that is equal to that without this phi hat 0. You're right. So when I said P plus here, I wasn't completely correct. It's the projection onto the positive Fourier coefficients. Right. Very good. Yeah. So anyways, it turns out to be this. What you should remember before we go on to the next thing, because we also now want to characterize the same expression in terms of the singular numbers of t. But first, let's just point out this the symmetry in here. So, HV operator norm squared is equal to T minus C BMO, and the HV Hilbert-Schmidt norm squared is the P minus C B a half 2. So you detect the operator norm. This is Nahari. You detect the operator norm by using the BMO norm of P minus C, and this is Peller and Rothberg. You detect the Hilbert-Schmidt norm, I guess I have to put wiggle here, by computing the B a half 2 boundary norm. So that's a nice calculation. One final thing we need before we can finish the approximation stuff next time is this.
the following definition. Or
oh, it's actually after 12.
Ah, okay, well, maybe I should do this next one then. This is the characterization of Hilbert Schmidt in terms of the singular numbers of t, and not the eigenvalues of t star t, but the singular numbers of t. That's the modulus of the lambdas I mentioned. So basically what happens is that we're going to prove that these two things, that this thing here is also the sum of the lambda k's, where these are actually now called the singular numbers.
The spectrum of t consists of spectral eigenvalues. It does not have a continuous spectrum except...
Compact operators don't have continuous. At zero, it just has an infinite dimensional kernel.
Or no, it may have no kernel.
It may have no kernel, but that's going to be tough.
Unless the space is finite.
Yeah, because if there's no kernel, then zero is not an eigenvalue. Means you only have finitely many positive eigenvalues. Yeah, a compact operator has the property that T minus lambda I kernel is finite dimensional, and the only lambdas that can be the only limit point of the eigenvalues is zero. So if and the spectrum is compact always. Yeah, we did that in so the spectrum is always compact, which means that if there is no kernel at zero, there's no eigenvalue at zero. So there's no accumulation point for the lambdas.
No, I think that zero could be an eigenvalue because t is not invertible. It doesn't mean that it has a kernel.